Hello, everyone. My name is Maggie from the Talking Information Center. Today is Thursday, the 9th of July, and I'll be reading from the Plymouth Independent. The first article today is titled, "We're in the Middle of a Big Dig. Is Business Buried by the Jenny Pond Restoration Project? Gillis Family Tavern Readies for a New Home Downtown." Written by Mark Pothier. On weekdays, police officers direct what limited traffic goes in and out of the Spring Lane lot, most generated by a pediatric dentist practice. Truck and tractor backup signals sound more regularly than the bird chirping. The mess and noise, while unavoidable, put a serious hurt on the Gillis Family Tavern. As work slowly progressed, the business became collateral damage. After enduring a year and a half of disruption and financial hardship, the restaurant closed at the end of May. But that's not where the Gillis's story ends. They plan to reopen later this year in the Main Street space, formerly filled by the notorious Proof 22 bar and restaurant. Jimmy Gillis and his son are busy working on the new location, but in the recent phone conversation, his excitement about the future was tempered by lingering resentment over the rocky path that forced the move. "It has been quite a nightmare," Jimmy said. "We lost at least $2,000 a day on lunch. I don't know how we survived as long as we did. Dinner service was less affected, but as the construction crew had packed up for the day. Thankfully, loyal customers were willing to navigate the work site at Lambeth. Tourists, however, took one look at the scene and headed elsewhere for their burgers and wings. They made no walkways for anyone to really get into the restaurant," Gillis said. "I don't even know how OSHA, the Federal Occupation and Health Administration, hasn't shut down this whole job zone. During the day, there's trucks going back and forth. There's no pedestrian safety walkways or anything. Basically, we're in the middle of a big dig." Gillis hoped for some form of financial help from the town or the federal government, which is partially funding the project through $10 million National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration grant that didn't happen. "On nights and weekends, we did very well," he said, "but not enough to carry the lunch money we were losing. I feel like the town of Plymouth could have done this a lot different and had some type of compensation for us. I'm not saying pay for everything, but there should have been some kind of leeway. It made us fall behind on all kinds of bills and taxes, and we had to dig out of our own pockets to make sure everyone got paid." Town manager Derek Brindisi called the work extremely complicated, a description anyone who surveyed the area can confirm. "It's far more involved than a beautification project. The job consists of an upgrading of the Jenny Pond Dam, improving the stormwater system, creating a fish bypass, and repairing the walkway to Brewster Gardens," Derek Brudisi said in his email. "The Department of Energy and Environment has been working closely with the area business to limit any negative impact and will continue to do so until the project completion. That's not likely to placate Jimmy and Brendan Gillis, but they don't have time to continue ruminating on the gristmill out debacle. They're grateful for the intervention of developer Rick Vaio, who owns a former Proof 22 space and was eager to erase the memories of that failed venture. We ultimately weren't happy with where the proof was going," Vaio said in the phone conversation. That relationship fizzled out. We wanted to make sure that the next relationship is what we want to see downtown. Taking a cue from the TV series Undercover Boss, he made two visits to the restaurant before striking the lease deal with the Gillis family. I went there without ever mentioning who I was, Vail said. I was very impressed with what they did. On one of those occasions, he brought the party of about 10, a stress test for the kitchen and servers. We had everything from pizza to salmon, he said. I think someone had a steak and someone else had a salad, and it was pretty wide range of what they prepared. Everything was spot on. They had a very nice wait staff, and everything came out on time. So I instantly went back to them and said, let's talk about what we can do here. Veo, who was focused on lifting the downtown to the next level borders on healthy obsession, says the tavern will find a fill a niche. My view has always been downtown Plymouth needs an eclectic mix of dining options, he said. We need three more cork and tables. No question about that. But we're also lacking a little bit in which what I call a term mid-tier or American cuisine. It can't all be like fine dining. What Gillis does is to prepare good food. They're putting in a lot of money into it. Gillis envisions the restaurant as an accessible bistro pub. You can have your pizza, your wings, salads, but you also can have a real good chicken or steak dinner, he said. I didn't want to say high-end, but better than mid-range. The atmosphere, he said, will be markedly different from the rowdy scene that marked weekend nights at the Proof 22 in a similar problematic predecessor, T-Bone Roadhouse. We want nothing to do with that, Gillis said. We took everything down to the walls. He described an interior that would feature exposed brick, a copper ceiling, antique chandeliers and wall stones, cherrywood floors, and unbelievably comfortable chairs. There will also be a requisite big screen TVs, but we're not going to overdo it, he said. Oh, and reasonable prices, too. We're still a family restaurant, Gillis said. He aims to be up and running in time to have those TVs showing NFL football games in September. But October may be more realistic, given the tangle of red tape involved in opening a restaurant. This is not a plan Gillis envisions when he opens the door at the gristmill, but despite the turmoil of the least 18 months, he sounds more excited than anxious about starting over. We'll be ready, he said. We're Irish stubborn. Next article is entitled Philharmonic's Popular Conductor Signs for at least another 5 years in Plymouth. Stephen Caridone's 32-year run continues until at least 2031, written by Julia Marie Davis. When Stephen Caridone's drove to Plymouth for the first time in the early 1990s as a candidate for the music director of the Plymouth Philharmonic Orchestra, he remembers cresting the rise on Somerset Street and catching his first glimpse of the ocean. My lungs filled up with air, he recalled. I thought I have to have this job. More than three decades later, Caridione's isn't ready to leave. The Plymouth Philharmonic has announced a new 5-year contract for its longtime music director and conductor, extending his tenure through June of 2031, and ensuring one of the South Shore's most recognizable cultural leaders will remain on the podium through at least his 37th season. Approved by the officer's board of directors, the contract began July 1st. As he does every year, Carrie Udonis conducted the Philharmonic on the 4th of July, another spectacular show for the 250th anniversary of our nation's birth. He is never reluctant to describe his love for what he does, and the Philharmonic's board and leadership are thrilled to have him continue. This new contract emphatically acknowledges the importance of Stephen's leadership and commitment to the Philharmonic's, board director Phil Hildebrandt said in announcing agreement. The upcoming season will mark the Philharmonic's 111th and Carrie Udonis' 33rd season, leading the orchestra, a tenure spanning much of its organization's modern history. Beginning a 33rd re-season with one organization is a remarkable milestone, said Kara McGurnan, executive director. Having worked alongside Stephen for nearly 9 years, I've seen firsthand his unwavering commitment to the Philharmonic, our musicians, and the community we serve. I'm grateful that we're continuing working together for at least 5 years as we continue building on the Philharmonic's legacy and looking forward to their future. A Boston native, Carrie Udonis has built an international career as a conductor and composer while making the Plymouth the center of the musical life. In addition to leading the Philharmonic, he is a music director of the New England Conservative Youth Symphony, has served as an underlying conductor for the Boston Pops since 2008, and made his Boston Pops conducting debut at the Symphony Hall in 2016. His guest conducting engagements have taken him through the U.S. and Europe, and his own compositions have been performed by orchestras from Pittsburgh to Australia. He's also served on the conducting facilities of both the New England Conservatory and the Boston University Tanglewood Institute. Yet Carrie Udonis has left perhaps with those lasting remark in Plymouth. When he arrived in 1994, the orchestra presented just 3 subscriptions and concerts and a single benefit performance each year. And today, the Philharmonic's offers a year-round season of classical masterworks, pop concerts, holiday performances, family programming, educational initiatives, and a community of collaboration now part of the cultural fabric of the South Shore. This season alone illustrates its growth. The orchestra opens September 19th with a program pairing Rossellini's, Borodin's, and Sarasate with internationally acclaimed violinist Irina Mary Sunu, while also presenting the world premiere of Alina Rushenova's Festival Celebration Music for Orchestra. Later in the fall comes the Philharmonic's popular holiday celebration, now expanded to 4 performances to meet the demand. Throughout the season, accomplished guests and artists and awarding musicians regularly travel to Plymouth, giving local audiences performances typically associated with a much larger metropolitan orchestra. My goal became that I wanted the Plymouth Philharmonic to be a career job, Carrie Udonis said. I wanted to see how far I could take it in the time that I had with it. He credits much of the success to the orchestra musicians who travel from across New England to perform in Plymouth. Our orchestra is an envy of all the orchestras, he said. Many major cities in this country wish they had an orchestra as strong as ours. Yet it takes a conductor to shape something inspiring enough to lure musicians, and Carrie Udonis shapes the future, not just of the orchestra, but in the cinch with the changing nature of the town. It was his first intention to make this job his career. Despite his national and international resume, he speaks mostly passionately about Plymouth. Plymouth has changed dramatically in the past 20 years, especially in the arts, he said. We're grateful to have been part of that growth. He's also grateful for the patrons who keep the doors open. The conductor describes the Philharmonic's audience as usually loyal. While many orchestras find listeners drawn primarily to either the classical or pop's programming, he said, Plymouth audience often support the entire season. We have audience members who just, because it is, he said, they love everything we do. Like many nonprofit art organizations, the Philharmonic relies heavily on the philanthropy. Ticket sales cover only a portion of the operating costs. And tickets revenue only gets us to intermission, he said. The rest has to come through fundraising. If anyone wondered where Caridoni's is having as much fun as his audience, they got the answers during the Philharmonic's June 28th. It's a tropical rock concert. He traded his baton for a microphone, joining the guest vocalists Scott Cartier, Travis Birch, Shalia Atkinson, Chris Blim, and pianist John Boswell for one of the afternoon's crowd favorites. The audience roared its approval and discovered that the longtime conductor can sing too. For now, his focus remains firmly on the future. Programming discussions already extended nearly 2 years ahead. He's involved in every single minute, from the planning to the rehearsals to the performance. Patrons see his energy watching him conduct. At the same time, Caridoni's said that he is mindful of the importance of eventually making a way for the next generation. I've seen what happens when conductors stay a year or too long, he said. I pray I have the courage and the clarity to step down a year or two early. For now, the conductor is preparing for another 5 years. My pillow might be in Boston, he said, but my heart's in Plymouth. The next popular article is Mayflower 2 set sail for Boston Tall Ship Parade. Plus, the Adams Family pricey Mayflower 2 sailing cruises, Shirkula opening, a carriage barn to talk at the Hedge House, and much more happenings. Written by Julia Marie Davis. The Mayflower 2 is a familiar sight along the Plymouth waterfront, but this month a historic vessel will leave her home berth to take part in one of the nation's largest maritime commemorations. From July 9th to the 17th, Mayflower 2 will travel to Boston for Sail Boston 2026, Sail 250, a centerpiece of our state's America's 250 celebration markings, the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The voyage is historic on several counts. May 2nd, Mayflower number 2 has never participated in a tall ship gathering on a scale of Sail Boston. It also marks the ship's first appearance in the Boston Harbor in 25 years. Plans to bring the vessel to Boston following the extensive restoration in 2020 were canceled because of the pandemic, making this long-awaited return especially meaningful. More than 4 million visitors are expected to attend the Sail Boston. The 106-foot ship's departure is set to sail at 7 a.m. Thursday. Towed by the Stettino's Marine of Fall River, although The schedule is dependent on weather and other factors. While the ship is in Boston at Van Pier, visitors can book a ticket for several different sailing experiences, including the spectacular parade of sail from aboard the ship on July 11th, or to enjoy a sunset sail through Boston Harbor on July 14th. These limited sailing experiences, starting at $2,500 per person, offer a rare opportunity to sail aboard a historic vessel. Officials at Plymouth Pawtucket Museum said the tickets were set up to help offset the expenses involved in participating in the Sail Boston. Last winter, the vessel traveled to the Mystic Seaport for routine maintenance. We hauled the ship out of the water, cleaned and painted the whole ship, and did some caulking, and just generally got her looking her best, said Captain Whit Perry, Kenshaw Save Junior Director of the Maritime and Historic Preservation at Plymouth Pawtucket Museums. This is how we ensure not only that Mayflower looks refreshed, but also provides the preventive maintenance that keeps her operational and protects her for the future. Like the original 17th century merchant vessel she replicates, Mayflower II has no propulsion system of her own and will travel to Boston with the assistance of a tug. Whenever the wind conditions allow, the crew hopes to raise the sail during the transition and while in Boston Harbor. For Plymouth Pawtucket Museums, participating in the Sail Boston is far more than showcasing one of the nation's best known historic ships. The Mayflower II is a float class and a tangible reminder of how revolutionary ideas started here in Pawtucket in Plymouth, said Tom Bigley, executive director of Plymouth Pawtucket Museums. We are honored to participate in the Sail Boston as a way to commemorate the United States centennial and to share this special educational resource with audiences gathered in the city for this historic event. Tom Bagley said that the festival provides an opportunity to introduce millions of visitors to the region's foundational role in American history. Millions of people are expected to attend the festival, creating new opportunity to engage the public in the vital history that played out in Pawtucket in Plymouth 400 years ago, Tom Bigley said. We're able to share with attendees that revolutionary idea started here and illustrate how the events of 400 years ago shaped those of the 250 years ago. Mayflower II is more than a symbol, Perry said. She is a living ship with a living story, and our entire maritime team is proud to steward and share the story with the city of Boston. Perry said that the voyage will include members of the museum's interpretive staff, volunteers, maritime apprentices, and professional mariners, giving them an opportunity to experience sailing the Mayflower as well. Mayflower II will be berthed at the Van Pier in Boston Seaport District. The ship will return to reopen for the public visitation in Plymouth on July 18th. Our final article today is Your View, Protect Firefighters from Carcinogens, written by Linda McDonald. I recently came across an Instagram profile of a group of Plymouth firefighters training for the Firefighters Challenge. The Firefighters Challenge is a nationwide sporting event in which firefighters are required to wear turnout gear while engaging in a series of simulated firefighting tasks. In an Instagram post, Plymouth firefighters wear full turnout gear to work out off-duty using the hoses, stairs, dummies, etc., associated with the fire drills. However, the IAFF, the International Association of Firefighters, has issued a safety advisory stating that turnout gear contains PFAS, forever chemicals linked to cancer, and should be only be worn when necessary, that is, during all phases of firefighting. When I asked the Instagram fighters where the gear was, they were wearing in their posts were PFAS-free. I did not receive the answer, but it was eventually blocked from the site. Like in all MA communities, the Plymouth is required to purchase PFAS-free turnout gear for its firefighters by January of 2027. A set of turnout costs towards upwards of $3,500, and each firefighter is expected to have at least two sets to account for cleaning between firefighting events. Plymouth has not yet purchased the PFAS fire gear, and as Quincy MA recently found, there is no guarantee new gear will not contain PFAS. The International Association of Firefighters has successfully lobbied many states and communities across the USA for a presumptive occupational cancer benefits that include the line of duty death benefits most of us associate with the loss of life while firefighting, and full tax-free pay while out on leave for treatment of cancer. The presumption means that any firefighter who gets cancer is presumed to have it because of their job, unless it's a medical board deemed it diagnosed unrelated. Since an International Association of Firefighters and I let today accept the ideas that are getting cancer and dying from it because of the FAS, other chemicals found in turnout gear and released during the fire from the product ubiquitously in our homes, then the casual wearing of our turnout gear for worked-out sporting events by some Plymouth firefighters irresponsible. It should be prohibited and not left up to the individual firefighters. Our select board and town members need to protect the taxpayers of Plymouth against the future and costly claims of occupational cancer by instituting a policy like that of Foxville, Massachusetts, which limits the wearing of turnout gear to calls for structural fires, vehicle fires, and natural gas odors. Like the prohibition against smoking by firefighters, any wearing of the gear contrary to the policy should be grounds for dismissal. As Superman once said, being a hero doesn't mean that you're invincible, nor does it mean that you can do whatever you want. That is all we have today for today. This is Maggie, and I thank you for listening to the Plymouth Independent.